WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Santa Claus goes by many names. Santa is one, of course. Kris Kringle is another. And then there's jolly old St. Nicholas. He's the guy we're going to talk about this hour because it was this man, this real man, who became the cultural icon we know. But he was also a Christian saint, a man who would significantly impact the history and development of the Christian church, or we think so. Adam English has done significant amount of research into this, looking into the life of St. Nicholas. The result is his book, The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. Dr. English is an associate professor of theology and philosophy at Campbell University, and he joins us for the hour from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Welcome to the program.
Mike, it is great to be with you.
Great. A quick note of warning for parents. Although we will do our best to control the conversation about the real story of Santa and why he became a saint, you might want to keep the little ones from the radio. Hint, hint, for obvious reasons here.
I do like to talk with children about the real St. Nicholas, and the way I like to phrase the conversation is to say, you know, I want to tell you about the first Santa Claus. And so children are very comfortable with the idea that there have been multiple Santa Clauses over the ages. And so, I am comfortable talking with kids and not ruining any family traditions.
Why this interest in St. Nicholas for you personally? Because I'm sure this took a lot of time and effort to put together this research and this book.
It did. I've been working on it for, the last 4 years. And it goes back to a chance I had to spend some time in Bari, Italy, which is where the bones of St. Nicholas are located. But more exciting to me than the bones is the archive library located next to the basilica where the bones are located, operated by some wonderful Dominican friars there. And inside of those archival libraries are just a treasure trove of documents about the original St. Nicholas, all just sort of pieces of information. And so my task then, as I saw it, was to go in and try to organize and try to, pull out the story of the original St. Nicholas, realizing immediately there was a wonderful story to be told here.
He's very popular in Europe. We don't talk much about him except at Christmas time here. Do you think that people would be surprised that there was a real St. Nicholas?
I think so. For some people, it does feel, especially in the American context, that the story, of course, is about Santa Claus, and St. Nicholas is a shadowy prologue to that story. I wanted to turn the tables and say Santa Claus is really a nice epilogue to the real story here, which is the story of St. Nicholas.
Now, you just mentioned the library at Bari, where his bones are interred, but you also say in the book that there is no early documentation of the man, no writings, no disciples, no major acts. Given that, why do we even know him, and what's in that library?
Well, and this is why I do think there is confusion and doubt at some of these points. For a historian, this is not an ideal situation. As you mentioned, Nicholas did not leave anything in his own hand, and his contemporaries do not mention him by name. The first documents we have regarding him are from 200 years later. And so, after 200 years, already there are the barnacles and the dust layers of legend that have attached themselves to his stories. So the work of the historian is to go back and try to scrape off some of the legend and find the real history underneath. Mm-hmm. But it's painstaking, and all the evidence we have is indirect and again coming from hundreds of years later. But it's sufficient. There are enough and diverse types of information to help us really establish a true historical pattern here and a true historical person.
You mentioned historian, and you are a professor of theology and philosophy. Did you approach this as an historian would, or did you approach this more from a theological perspective?
That is an interesting question. I definitely saw myself as a scholar trying to do, the best scholarly work that I could. not being a historian by nature, more working in the area of theology, but in historical theology. So I've always been drawn to the historical tradition and to the history of things. I've primarily been interested in the history of ideas, and this project has drawn me into the history of a person.
Hmm. Philosophically speaking, does he have some interest for you?
He does. I have become increasingly interested in the lives of saints as a theologian, you know, as a philosopher, because you know, as I read the early church and as I read their theology and the things they were thinking about, the lives of saints keeps coming up, and so the early Christians were just as interested in how to live, practically live the Christian life, as they were in how to think about it and how to articulate it in terms of theology. And that struck me. I had not really encountered that in most of the history of theology books that I've read. Most of them focus on ideas, but the early church was just as focused on living it out.
You know, that interesting that you bring that up, because there are people out there who go to church on Sunday, and then some go to church again on Wednesday and other days of the week.
Right.
And yet in their daily lives, they lose sight of how to put that into practical application. Is that something we've lost in general? Were they better at it back then? Or were they more fervent about it back then? How would you compare the two times?
Well, that would be tough to do, except simply to say that for the early church, the Christian life was organic, and so it was more than what you do on a Sunday morning or what you might believe in your mind, but it's also what you do with your hands and your feet and your whole body and your whole life. And so getting to the saints is, in those saints' lives, is a way to kind of pick up that strand that I do think we're missing sometimes when we talk simply about ideas. Christian faith gets reduced down to sound bites or to simply an affirmation of an idea or a doctrine. But really, it should be more of a way of life, a way of going about one's daily business and how one interacts with one's neighbors.
You spent 4 years researching this book and writing this book, and yet you wrote in the blog that the three most important 20th century scholars to study St. Nicholas came to the conclusion that he quite possibly never existed, or if he did, it was unlikely that he did any of the things attributed to him. And still, you embarked on this research. So what conclusions did you come to as a result of all of this?
You know, the 20th century scholarship, just in general, had a very suspicious, negative view of anything that had maybe the taint or smack of miracle to it, so that you find people in the 20th century, scholars, even doubting the existence of Jesus and the witness of the Gospels, and so really pulling apart anything that, again, smacked of the supernatural. And so St. Nicholas fell victim to this as well, and was, in fact, removed from as a red letter day in the Roman Catholic calendar, and, you know, and removed as a genuinely historical person from the records of most people and most minds. And so even in the Dictionary of Saints and those kinds of popular sources, he's been reduced to a legendary character. You know, but to me, this is what finding these documents, then why they were so important then, was to be able to say, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe we have overstepped ourselves here and we need to go back to the primary documents and really take a second look at what we have, and to really reverse public opinion about the life of Nicholas and say, no, he really did exist, and we can document it with fair amount of certainty.
Given his popularity in Europe, I mean, he really is popular in Europe. There are hundreds of churches named after him, and the people in Russia revere him, etc. Why hasn't somebody else looked through the primary material prior to this to pin down exactly who he was and what he was all about prior to doing it?
Yes, and in Europe, it is more well accepted that he is a historical individual who really existed. One of the Dominican friars there at the libraries, Irallo Schofri, has written some in Italian demonstrating some of these very same things. I would say it's just really in the American context, you know, that we have truly lost any historical perspective on it. But you're right, very popular in Europe. Like I say, numerous churches dedicated to him. Also celebrated throughout the year. I mean, this is one of the things that's surprising maybe for our American listeners. We think of him associated with Christmas Day, but if you had been in Velikoretsky, Russia this past June, you would have seen 35,000 pilgrims walking 100 miles to a St. Nicholas shrine. If you'd been in St. Nicholas de Port in France, around Whit Monday, which is the Monday after Pentecost this year, you've seen a huge procession in honor of Nicholas. And then in Bari, Italy, in May 9th, there are thousands of people that come out for parades in honor of Nicholas. So he's celebrated throughout the year in Europe. And, you know, we simply remember him as Santa Claus on the 24th and 25th of December.
Why all those different places? Because he was from Turkey, and I would think at the time he lived, he didn't travel all that much because it would have been incredibly difficult to go from Turkey to Italy to Russia to other places around the area, and dangerous. So why is he so celebrated in these far-flung countries?
St. Nicholas was first and foremost the patron saint of sailors, interestingly enough, not children, but sailors. And so sailors loved St. Nicholas. There are many stories of St. Nicholas getting on board with the sailors and rolling up his sleeves and pitching in with the oars and the ropes. So sailors carried icons and statues and, of course, stories of Nicholas everywhere they went, up rivers and around seas, and quickly spreading the stories of St. Nicholas, you know, far and wide. So St. Nicholas had a distinct advantage, perhaps, over other saints who didn't have quite as wide of a distribution in having fans in the sailors.
Hmm. Now, as you set out to do this research and you combed through this and collated it all, you said that it was very difficult to uncover the facts because it was separating the fact from the folklore was almost impossible without permanently scarring or even losing the person because they're so tightly joined. What was the end result? Why so difficult to separate fact from fiction when you're looking at the primary research? And what happens when you find out the facts?
Here's where I think we as modern people are perhaps at a disadvantage. We like to compartmentalize, and we like... Think about your Barnes & Noble. We like our fiction section and our history section to be two distinct, sections. But pre-modern writers and just human beings did not conceive that way. They were perfectly fine to meld history and legend together in some ways that would disturb ordinary people today and modern historians. And so the earliest stories we have of Nicholas are, you know, what we would call tainted with legend, but for them, this was not problematic. This was just simply the way to tell a good story and to remind people of the history. So we call it today hagiography is the big word we use, the lives of saints. You know, for them, it was just good storytelling and good history. And so there were some real tensions there in trying to separate out some of the folklore from the real history. One of the discoveries is that there are actually two individuals named Nicholas. Today, if you went onto Wikipedia or just, you know, think of your popular retellings of the story of St. Nicholas and as that individual, probably it's actually two individuals that ultimately are named St. Nicholas.
We'll talk together. Yeah, we'll talk about them when we come back from the break in just a couple of seconds. Dr. Adam English, our guest, his book is called The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting A Christmas Carol, the Dickens holiday classic with Ebenezer Scrooge and the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. Now through Sunday, tickets at carolinatix.org, and Founders Federal Credit Union, providing products and services to simplify financial life for over 50 years with 25 locations across the Carolinas. Information at foundersfcu.com. Well, here in town, housing sales and housing prices appear to be slowly rising, and that's good news for an economic sector that was decimated by the recession. Is it also an accurate indicator that we are out of the woods in this recession? Well, we'll ask Dr. John Connaughton that when he joins us to talk about the state's official economic forecast. We'll also find out if his previous quarterly predictions have proven to be accurate and what he sees ahead for next year. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the availability of 3D mammograms renews debate about who should get them and when, calculating the health benefits of routine mammograms.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Adam English, Associate Professor of Theology and Philosophy at Campbell University and the author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra, the first Santa Claus, kids, in case you're listening. And is that right? M-Y-R-A is Myra or is it Mira?
I've heard it Myra.
Okay.
I think that's the proper pronunciation.
Just prior to the break, we're talking about the possibility that all these years people have been talking about Nicholas. They've actually been talking about two people, two men named Nicholas. And you mentioned that part of the problem is that around the time of his life, between 270 and 343 AD, Nicholas was beginning to become a prevalent name in that part of the world at that time. So these two people named Nicholas, how different were they and who contributed what to the legend that we now know, that we now associate with St. Nicholas?
There, you know, as I was mentioning, these two individuals, Nicholas of Myra and then this Nicholas of Sion, who lived about 200 years later, but in a very similar area, and they did do some similar things, but about 1,000 years ago, around 900 or thereabouts, there's two stories got merged together. And hey, everybody likes, two stories are better than one, I guess. And so if you could tell a more elaborate story and just combine the two, wouldn't that be better? And so again, even into modern times, even until today, those two stories are often told as if they were one. So for instance, just one example, sometimes when you hear the life of Nicholas, sometimes people will talk about a pilgrimage that Nicholas makes to the Holy Land and spend some time there. In fact, there's even a church there today that claims to have been the Church of St. Nicholas and founded by this St. Nicholas. Well, in fact, this is the other St. Nicholas. So that's just one example of that mistake that, again, is just sort of perpetuated. So what the book does then is really try to separate those two individuals out and keep them separate, which I think is important for history.
So the St. Nicholas that we associate with Christmas in this country, at least, you write about you went to the tomb in Bari, Italy, and they opened that tomb in 1953, and the bones within it were submerged in what you describe as a clear liquid like water from a rock. And every year, the monks tap the water, and they fill vials with it, I guess, and what, sell it? So where does this water come from?
Right. This is perhaps the most foreign and alien part of St. Nicholas for our American listeners. The what we would call water, but it's called variously oil or myrrh or unguent from the tomb, is collected every day, every year on May 9th, still to this day. Nicholas's bones have been, or the tomb has been leaking out liquid now since the time of his burial, and so obviously this liquid is seen as special, as holy water, as miraculous, and so venerated in its own right. There were other saints who also seeped out liquid myrrh or oil, but Nicholas is one of the last remaining that still does to this day.
Well, there are pictures of him with his clothes, I guess because of his association with sailors and being on the sea, his clothes soaked in brine, his beard dripping water. Has anybody made some sort of mystical connection between that and the water in the tomb?
Oh, sure, sure. yeah, definitely. You know, it's so you can actually buy, you know, little vials of this water. They collect it and then dilute it. The Russians like theirs mixed with oil, and the Roman Catholics like theirs just mixed with water.
And what do they do with it? They don't drink this, do they?
You know, you can – well, you could drink it, I suppose, if you're truly dire. But you can use it for anointing the sick, or just, you know, rubbing it on sores, or, you know, just whatever.
Okay, because his bones are submerged in this water until they drain
it. Right.
Nicholas, you point out that it is Coca-Cola who is responsible for creating the image of Santa as we know him. It was a marketing campaign back in the early part of the 20th century. And that image is far removed from the oldest available image of St. Nicholas. According to that image, what did he look like?
The BBC did a documentary a couple of years ago in which they took the bones and the skull, some imaging of the skull, and made a digital reconstruction of the head and face of Nicholas. And, you know, they gave him an olive skin complexion and a white beard. He did die at an elderly age, so that would be appropriate. One of the interesting findings is that he has a significant nose break, and so, you know, speculations abound. Did he get in some kind of fight, or was he hit, or what happened to break his nose? We could only speculate at this point. Most of the early images of Nicholas are not of him being jolly and smiling and rosy cheeked, but very stern, as a bishop would be, and not at all friendly. So he was known not only for generosity, but for justice, for being a stern disciplinarian. And that carries over just a little bit into our modern-day Santa Claus traditions. You think of Santa up at the North Pole with his list of naughty and nice.
Yes.
And knowing who's been good and who's been bad. You know, that is just an echo of the original St. Nicholas, who was very much known for sorting out characters and knowing good from bad and being very much concerned with justice.
And you've said that that's part of it, that may be part of his appeal, that he doled out rewards, but he also challenged the pagans and was willing to confront people for their transgressions. Is that part of what you discovered as a result of the research in the library there at Barry, or did you already know that?
Well, it was a discovery for me, just to see that St. Nicholas, again, is more than a bringer of gifts. He was equally a civic servant. There are stories of him rescuing three innocent men from beheading, stories of him stopping a grain ship and bartering for supplies to save the city of Myra from famine. Stories of him traveling to the capital to request lower taxes on behalf of the city. So he was much more than a good pastor, much more than, you know, a jolly gift giver. He was also a public servant, someone who was invested in the common good.
Now, I mentioned at the very beginning of the program that he may have had some significant impact on early Christianity, and he did, I'm told, attend the Council of Nicaea, the first ever ecumenical council, the main accomplishments of which were settlement of the issue of the nature of Jesus and his relationship to God the Father, so it was a definition of the Trinity and how it existed, the construction of the first part of the Creed of Nicaea, and the settling the calculation of the date of Easter and the promulgation of early canon law in the Christian Church. On the one hand, he's credited with having an impact on the early Church, but you say that it is not clear that he contributed anything of importance to the proceedings. So, in light of that, did he have an impact?
He was definitely in attendance at that very important council, and as you kind of went through the list there, and your church history buffs out there will definitely know Nicaea was perhaps the most important council in church history, settling out some of those very important issues. Who is Jesus? And of course, if Christianity is anything, it is about Jesus Christ. And so it was really at that council that some of those beliefs about Jesus were stabilized and articulated in some very important ways. As far as the records go, there are very few records as to the actual proceedings of what happened in the councils. We have lists of who were there and sort of the opening ceremonies and then the outcomes. But as to the actual proceedings, some of that it comes through legend. There's a fun legend about Nicholas that the arch-heretic, a man named Arius, was standing up and spouting off errors about the nature of Jesus. Nicholas simply could not contain himself, stands up and punches him. And, you know, that's a great image and a great story. Unfortunately, it's not true, although I have seen a T-shirt picturing Santa Claus holding a pair of sandals, and it says, you know, I've been sandal slapped by Santa, which I would love to get, you know, that T-shirt. But it is not, unfortunately, it's not true. Although it maybe points to some of his temperament, some of his, you know, very much concern for justice and for character.
Well, is it true that he attended the Council of Nicaea? Because you admit the records are sketchy and that there is a possibility that someone later in time simply wrote in people who should have been there. So was he there? How do we know he was there?
This is where, again, the work of the historian gets very muddled. There are multiple lists from Nicaea, some ranging from 200 people in attendance, others up to 300 in attendance. Nicholas's name is not in the list of people of 200. The lists have about 200 people. He's not in any of those lists, but he's in all the lists that list 300 people in attendance. And we have other records that indicate there were more like 300 people there than 200. So I think we can give credence to those lists of 300 as being accurate. Perhaps a list of 200 people in attendance were just the prominent members who were there. But the fuller list seemed to be those of 300. I know that gets technical, but we do seem to have enough sufficient evidence to say that with confidence that he was there.
Adam English is an associate professor of theology and philosophy at Campbell University and the author of a new book called The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, about St. Nicholas. We have some listeners already wanting to contribute to this conversation, and you can do so at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, where Turk writes, at least on Facebook, he writes, "Finally, as a Turkish person, I've always been laughed at when I told my American friends that St. Nick is from Turkey. On a related note, for a small donation, I can help your listeners move up on the nice list." yes, he's from Turkey, where I guess, did he know Constantine? Did he play a role in Constantine's conversion to Christianity? Because he was around at a time, he lived his life at a time when, at the beginning of his life, it was illegal to be Christian. And by the end of his life, a third or more of the world was Christian, of the Western world was Christian.
That's right. He lives at a remarkable moment, a remarkable transition period, living through some of the very worst parts of persecution. In the year 303, the last and most horrific persecution was unleashed upon the church by the Roman Empire, I should say, the Emperor Diocletian. And hundreds were put to death. Hundreds more were sent to the mines or maimed or imprisoned. And there are indications that Nicholas, who was a bishop at this time, or head pastor of the church at Myra, was also rounded up and at least imprisoned, punished in some ways, but not put to death. But as you say, by his death, Christianity has not only been legalized, but has also become the favored religion of the empire, the Roman Empire. And so Nicholas has to oversee the building of new churches and the new converts coming rushing into the church from all directions. So he sees just a massive transition.
And plus, he's from Turkey in Constantinople, which was Istanbul.
Or Byzantium, and then Constantinople, and then Istanbul. Now Istanbul.
Yeah. That's right. He's in Turkey.
That's right. So Constantine was definitely at the Council of Nicaea as well. He oversaw the proceedings. Nicholas certainly could have seen him there. There are other stories of Nicholas appearing before Constantine, and some of those we have to take with maybe a grain of salt as being perhaps legendary. For instance, there is the account of him going to the capital and meeting with Constantine about the lowering of taxes, and perhaps part of that seems to be historical. Then there's a fun legend that has been added onto the end of that story. He appears before Constantine, who grants him lower taxes. Nicholas is smart enough to get that new order in writing from Constantine. He steps out of the courts of Constantine, and Nicholas immediately ties this new edict to a stick, tosses it into the ocean where it bobs off and floats up on the shores of Myra. The people find it and put it into effect. Meanwhile, Constantine has changed his mind and recalls Nicholas to his courts and says, I think I acted in haste. I need that edict back. I need to raise taxes once more for you. Nicholas can only apologize and say, I'm sorry, but the edict's already in effect, and it's too late, which is a lot of fun. Nicholas sort of outsmarting the Constantine and the Roman government for the sake of lowering taxes. Who doesn't like that story?
Let's take a call from Okan, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, who is with the American Turkish Association of North Carolina. Is that correct, Okan?
Yes, it is.
Welcome.
Thank you. So I just wanted to briefly mention our community organization here in Charlotte. It's called American Turkish Association of North Carolina at Charlotte. And we do have a website. It's called charlotteturks.org. People can go to that website to learn more about cultural happenings that taking place in Charlotte. We do have.
So, this is a conversation about St. Nicholas. Do you have a comment about that?
Yes, my comment about it is that people can read more about it on the Turkish cultural ministry website. So if they go to that, they can look at, read more about it,
okay,
and see how they can manage their travel if they wanted to go check it out.
Okay, and again, the website address is what?
If you type Turkish cultural ministry on Google, that will come up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Carrie on Facebook says, our family observes St. Nicholas Day on the 6th. I tell a very simple story the night before, and the children leave treats for him and his horse. In the morning, he's filled their boots with clementines. Those are oranges. Mm-hmm. Nuts to crack, a few chocolates, and an ornament or small toy. We learned about St. Nicholas and other saints through Waldorf education curricula, blogs, and websites, and were inspired to observe the day. Since St. Nicholas isn't a part of our religious tradition, I try to approach it historically while remaining respectful.
Those are some very fantastic Dutch traditions to have the shoes left out on St. Nicholas Eve and have them filled with, like I say, clementine with oranges and nuts and chocolate coins. A wonderful Dutch practice.
Does Santa Claus visit that part of the world, or is it St. Nicholas who visits that part of the world?
It's very much St. Nicholas. Of course, as with everything, Santa Claus is making his presence felt around the world through movies and American television. And so, you will find Santa Claus throughout the world, in Japan and in Russia and everywhere now. However, yes, it's St. Nicholas is truly, the character to be celebrated, especially in the Dutch Netherlands, for instance. He still arrives by boat from Spain, interestingly enough, and processes out on a white horse, meets with the mayor. He's traveling with Zwarte Piet. He's delivering oranges to the children. But he is very much dressed in bishop's garb and with the mitre and stole and all that.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about how St. Nicholas morphed into what we now think of as Santa Claus and why there is this association between these two characters. We're going to come right back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and James McElroy & Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences for over 50 years. JMDlaw.com. The availability of 3D mammograms renews debate about who should get them and when. Calculating the health benefits of routine mammograms, the topic at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. That's about 20 minutes from right now. If you'd like to join our conversation about jolly old or not so jolly old St. Nick, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I knew that when I finally had to say goodbye to Killian, it would be tough because he was such a huge part of my life. I had to schedule the time for him to be picked up as a time that I wasn't there because I would just lose it. It was just great to know that he was making radio now. He wasn't just sitting in my driveway. My name is Jessica Frazier. I donated my 1994 Chevy Lumina to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Adam English, our guest, Associate Professor of Theology and Philosophy at Campbell University and the author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. We're going to talk a little bit about St. Nicholas as a gift giver and how that part of his personality came into the person that we now know as Santa Claus. Martin writes about his observation of St. Nicholas, a Netherlands celebration, which is on the 5th, the eve of St. Nicholas's birthday. Or actually, I think that is actually the day he died, isn't it, December the 6th?
It is.
Yeah.
This is where, you know, again, legend starts to meld with history. For the saints, the death day was then celebrated as their birthday in heaven. So if you find it in older writings, they might say that the birthday of this saint is celebrated on this day, when we might think historically they mean the death day, but it's their birthday in heaven.
Okay.
So the dates, you know, those words kind of get mixed.
So Martin says a couple of observations about St. Nicholas and the day. At one's home, children placed there. We talked a little bit about this last segment. Placed their wooden shoes with goodies for the horse near the fireplace in the hope that in the early morning the good children will see these items replaced by chocolate bars and candy. The naughty ones get the switch. And this is what he experienced, he says, when he was young. And now older, he says, I see to my dismay that packages are pre-wrapped with a bow and presented without creative participation of the child. A sorry affair, because children at this age should be encouraged to create. Let them be and do. Not in this society, I am very sad to say. So Santa Claus is a gift giver. St. Nicholas was too, wasn't he? He gave away his own possessions. Do we know how that started or why?
Nicholas, when he was a young man, not yet a bishop or even a Christian pastor, but he had recently inherited a sum of money from his deceased parents. He heard about a man in town who had three daughters, and they were on the brink of destitution, so poor that the man was faced with the possibility of selling his daughters off. And so Nicholas decides to do something, and in the middle of the night, he bags up some of that gold and, going anonymously by this man's house, tosses the bag through the window. It's found in the morning, and the money is used as a dowry so that one of the daughters might be able to marry out of this circumstance. Nicholas returns two more times to bring two more gifts for the other daughters so that they might marry. Later legend and will embellish the story and say, and he came by and found the windows locked, and so dropped the bag of gold down the chimney where it landed in a stocking that was hanging by the fireplace to dry. And so, but you can clearly see the connection, of course, between St. Nicholas and that story and the modern Santa Claus traditions.
Well, now, it was common practice back then for families to sell their daughters if they couldn't afford a dowry. So that part of the legend is probably true. Mm-hmm. But what would have provoked him to do this, and where did he get the gold?
Right, inherited it from his parents. He seems moved by his Christian convictions that this is exactly what a Christian should be doing with their money and time. They should be helping out their neighbors who are less fortunate. And so it truly is a remarkably unique story that is being told. Yeah. And it seems to smack of real history. The other stories about saints at that time had saints dying in grisly ways, or maybe performing fantastical miracles in the desert. But, you know, here Nicholas is doing a completely ordinary act of kindness, saving these three daughters from their miserable fate. And, you know, it's inspiring. It's inspiring today, and it was inspiring at the time. So that already by the 1100s, you have nuns in France who are making little toys and leaving them on the doorsteps of children and signing them from St. Nicholas. He inspires action, and it's precisely coming from those Christian convictions about helping your neighbor.
Do we know if that story is true or whether it's simply legend?
You know, I try to work through that in the book and give evidence to say that it does have all the markings of a true historical story, and partly, again, simply from its uniqueness, that it's not a copy of some other kind of story, but it stands out. And, of course, historical events are unique, and that is one of the markings of a true historical event, is that, you know, there's nothing else like it that's being told at the moment.
So that's just one of the examples of the gifts he gave over his lifetime to certain people that he saw as deserving or in need or a way to put into practice the principles of his Christian faith. But how did that come to be associated with Christmas? How did he become associated with Christmas? How do we get from that to Santa?
Right. So St. Nicholas's feast day of celebration is December 6th at the start of the Christmas season. And traditionally, gifts have been given on December 5th or December 6th. And so already there is a celebration of Nicholas. There are cookies and there are gifts that are being given by the Dutch. The English traditionally celebrated gift giving on New Year's Day. And so, you know, eventually in the American context, between the Dutch giving gifts on St. Nicholas Day and the English giving gifts on, you know, Boxing Day or New Year's Day, eventually those coalesce on Christmas Day. And so you can kind of see the connection there.
And of course, we have this man sitting around in the first century of the Christian church, and he's in the area of Turkey, and he's establishing he's setting this example of giving gifts to those in need. But Santa gives gifts to everybody and lives at the North Pole. So how did that happen? Why the move? It's warm in Turkey. Santa should have stayed there.
I know. And, you know, the whole Santa Claus tradition is a product of the early 19th century America, especially in New York. There are some prominent citizens like John Pintard and Washington Irving and those connected with the New York Historical Society who are looking for traditions or looking for roots in their Dutch heritage. And they hit upon Sinterklaas on St. Nicholas. To be Dutch is to celebrate St. Nicholas, to make those St. Nicholas cookies and to give gifts. And so it just made sense to bring St. Nicholas into the equation and really promote his day as a way, again, of celebrating Dutch heritage. They're also looking for ways to domesticate the Christmas season in the early 19th century, and even before that, Christmas had been not what we think of today, but a very raucous sort of celebration, a carnival celebration. It is the end of the growing period. It's the time when the new beer and new wine are ready. It's the time of year when we begin slaughtering meat, and so fresh meat is available. And so people are out carousing and caroling and you know, staying up all night drinking and so on and so forth. And so to bring St. Nicholas in and really domesticate it is something they want to do. So think of the poem, The Night Before Christmas. You have St. Nicholas visiting the home. It's a very warm and domestic and nostalgic scene. And so they're trying to create new traditions and also trying to get people off the streets and into the homes and to make it a family affair instead of, you know, a loud and raucous affair.
We did a whole program on this. You're exactly right. Washington Irving was involved in this in New York because people used to come to the doors of wealthy people's homes and demand on Christmas Day, they would demand to be fed. And if you didn't feed them, they would trash your house. So they tried to domesticate the holiday and make it a family-oriented holiday.
So one of the interesting things is that in the colonies and even some of the states, Christmas was illegal
yes.
to practice. and as you look back, you think, gosh, what you know, what's going on? Are these, is this some kind of anti-Christian legislation? Don't celebrate Christmas. No, it's all about trying to keep the rowdiness at a minimum.
Yeah.
Of course, we have a holdover of that when we think of our modern day celebrations of New Year's Eve, which is expected that people will go out and stay out all night and maybe eat and drink too much. You know, that was the whole Christmas season.
So they moved
generations
to the
past.
Yeah, they moved to the very end of the year. So Santa is associated with children primarily.
Yes.
Was St. Nicholas? He wasn't, was he?
Not particularly. No, originally celebrated by sailors, but then very quickly becomes the patron saint of all kinds of groups, bakers and brewers and apothecaries and unmed women. And then, of course, the children as well. He takes care of these three young girls, and so his association with children becomes evident through that story. But I think he appeals to all kinds of people precisely because he is an ordinary kind of saint. He's not performing miracles. He's not writing big books of theology. He is doing simple acts of generosity, simple acts of justice that inspire anybody. And so, you know, children pull into that as well then, as Nicholas is not only going to take care of you know, the high and the powerful, but also the lowly, those who are forgotten, the children as well.
Yeah, but it's interesting what lasted, and what's lasted is this association with gift giving, because you just mentioned he's acts of justice, which mm-hmm. are things like giving people a dowry so they don't have to sell their daughters into prostitution. But on the other hand, it is standing up to the pagans and people who were not living Christian lives and telling them, hey, this is not the way to do it. And as you say, he's alleged to have punched somebody out, mm-hmm. And of course, his skull shows a significant problem with his nose being broken, but it could have happened after death, I suppose, but it also could have happened in life.
Right.
They simply don't know. So what kinds of things did he do that were stern, shall we say?
In his life, you know, again, I mentioned a story of him stopping the beheading of three innocent men and then proceeding to the judge's chambers to reprimand the judge for the miscarriage of justice. A number of the stories have him, you know, again, sternly reprimanding people who have misused their power in some ways. And so that already by the Middle Ages, he's depicted with a whip in hand. We think of Santa Claus having a whip for the reindeer, but St. Nicholas would have used the whip on naughty individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is known for his sternness.
Wow.
And the early image of him have him as a very stern, you know, individual. And again, as your writer mentioned, you know, of course, he can not only leave gifts, but he might leave a switch or a lump of coal for you if he judges you unfit.
You mentioned all these things that he is the patron saint of, and one of the things you didn't mention, which I believe is true, is that he's the patron saint of pawnbrokers. And some say that the symbol used by many pawn shops, those three dangling gold balls, mm-hmm. represent the three bags of gold that he threw into the house of the man needing dowries for his daughters. He's also the patron saint, I'm told, of prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, that one goes back to the story of Nicholas liberating these three individuals from beheading and then also liberating three other generals in the Roman army from a false accusation. And so you see him represented in art, you know, talking to these three individuals imprisoned, and sometimes that picture it has him talking to them in kind of the prison tower. And later legend kind of looked at that and said, you know, what is this prison tower? It might be a barrel. And so maybe Nicholas is resurrecting three individuals from a barrel. And so you have a story that is very strange about Nicholas going into an innkeeper who has butchered three young children and stuffed them into a pickle barrel, and Nicholas raises them to life. So you hear some weird stories like that and think, how did that get connected?
Hmm.
You know, there are all these little traces of legend that find their way into our storybooks.
Now, I'm going to ask a question about Santa Claus here that little ones might not want to hear. So I'm giving a fair warning here so that you can do something about that before I ask the question. We talked about earlier how the modern image of Santa was crafted by an artist on behalf of Coca-Cola in the early 20th century. Prior to that, was there a Claus, and was there an image that we had of him? Was it more like Saint Nick, or was there an image at all?
The images, especially in the 19th century, fluctuated a good bit. And if you look back at some of those, they don't look anything like a jolly gift giver. But late in that century, you have Thomas Nast, and then Norman Rockwell, you know, and then Haddon Sundblom, working for the Coca-Cola company, Haddon Sundblom, who begin to create warm, nostalgic images of Nicholas with the rosy cheeks and the plump belly. Mm-hmm. And so that image was in existence before the Coca-Cola company stepped in, but just barely. They really helped to stabilize that image. There are all kinds of images of St. Nicholas prior to that.
Did they
use
the
one we think of is the Coca-Cola image.
Did they use any of the attributes of St. Nicholas when they created that image, or did they just make it about a whole cloth?
They really almost make it out of whole cloth. Okay. You don't see any Christian symbolism on Santa Claus. I mean, he's a thoroughly elfish kind of character. I mean, he's in red, which I guess would echo maybe the bishop's robes. You know, but that's about it. I mean, you compare him to the modern day European Saint Nicholas, who still has a mitre and a staff.
Yeah,
and
I have a less than a minute left here, and here in this country we have this tune, this Christmas song, Jolly Old St. Nicholas, and so it's mm-hmm. become morphed into Santa Claus. Over there in Europe, it is completely different. What kind of a future do you see for these two individual characters?
You know, that's the wonderful thing about Christmas and Santa Claus and St. Nicholas. Each generation creates new traditions for him. And so, you know, there are just endless ways that every new tradition and every new generation will go with him. And that's what's fun about it.
Dr. Adam English is Associate Professor of Theology and Philosophy at Campbell University and the author of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra, The Real Story of Santa and Why He Became a Saint. Thank you for the hour.